tonight on Arena. Seamus O'Rourke on his new play, The Ballad of Mossy Flood, and Joe Lee on 406 Days, his documentary about the Debenhams workers. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Ballad of Mossy Flood is the latest one-man show from writer, poet and actor Seamus O'Rourke. Mossy is from Longford, a man living on his own with his dog Toto since his mother died. Someone you'd be foolish to underestimate, though it's easily done. Mossy is shrewder than he looks. Seamus is currently in preview with The Ballad of Mossy Flood at the Viking Theatre in Clontarf in Dublin before going on the road with the play to 30 venues around the country. And delighted that Seamus O'Rourke joins me now. I'm guessing from the dressing room of the Viking at this point in time, Seamus.
Oh, you've just caught me mid warm up. So if I'm out of breath, you'll know. Yeah. I know. Anyone that knows me knows I don't bend and I don't break.
So. So you were out there doing a little bit, getting the voice in shape for the 8 o'clock performance this evening, were you?
Yeah, I mean it's just a wonderful wee theatre out here, and it's been a great starting ground for Mossy Flood, and I've taken a little note from the stand up comics and get my work out in front of an audience and see how it fits with them. So I've been it's been a kind of a work in progress for the last two and a half weeks out here, and it's been fantastic, and you know, all sorts of the strange difference between doing a show up here in Dublin and at home is that you get all sorts. And I had people in from Minnesota last night, and another night we had people from Alaska and all sorts of places. Mm. So that's great. And they're getting it. So that's good.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about places like Minnesota, places like Alaska. Mossy is a small town or a small rural area. That's the type of man he is. He's from a small community like that.
Yeah.
And I suppose any country, any state, any place has these small communities. That possibly is why it transfers. Tell us a little bit about him and his situation, if you would, Seamus. Mossy, that is.
Mossy is... He's a man living on his own, and he's one of these people we would have, it's hard to get a PC word for these guys now. We would have said years ago he was a little bit slow, but and at the same time cuter than you'd think. You know, if you stopped to get directions from Mossy, you probably wouldn't take on board what he'd tell you. But at the same time, these people were always looked after by their communities, and it's I say sometimes it's since we started trying to look after them that we've made our mistakes. You know, they were quite happy, and sometimes these kind of people were being made fun of, but usually just well looked after within the community. So I wanted very much to tell the story through Mossy's voice rather than people coming to see an actor doing all sorts of different characters. I wanted the story very much told from Mossy, and Mossy doesn't necessarily have to be the greatest mimic or the greatest character actor. His version of the other people around him, you know, it just creates for more fun and more authenticity, I suppose. But, you know, he is from a very small place, as I am. You know, I'm on the borders of Longford and Leitrim and Cavan. And so it's a kind of a strange mix. You have three provinces all meeting in the same place. And so I've grown up with these sort of people. And I just love writing about them because I think they're so interesting and funny.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we all know the song Lochree, O Lochree, where the three counties meet, with that being Longford, yeah. Westmeath and Roscommon. But in this case, Longford, Leitrim, and what is the third one that's gone out of my head now?
Cavan,
of course, yeah. my fellow Ulster county, how could I forget that one? It's interesting that you have three provinces at this particular junction. Does that play into the nature of the man in any way, do you think, Seamus?
I think it does. I think it plays into the nature of all of us that grew up around there. You know, most lots of communities are very much within, self-contained, and they have their own, you know, very much their own place and their own county. Whereas we were kind of always, Kind of in the middle of all of them. So we took in everything, and not maybe as clannish as some would be. That's, they keep telling me that's why we never won a senior championship in Carrigallen, because we're too open. So it's an interesting. I've always felt it an interesting place to come from, and full of characters and colour, which is what I wanted the play to be about.
Yeah, which is certainly what we get in there from. I mean, I read, I suppose, a version of the script that I'm sure is changing as you're playing it out in front of the audiences during this preview period. But maybe if we get a, if you give us a little section from the script, I suppose, while he is part of that community, it's his family and particularly the mammy that's a vital part of the care system for Mossy, really, isn't it, Seamus?
Yes, it is. I'll just and I'll just go straight into it, maybe, because he says, Mammy was getting the road sharp that time when she brought us all off to the river years ago. And she said she was going to drown us. Of course, Mammy wasn't drowning a fly, but she was just so fed up with us. She had 11 of us all together, 11 children under the age of 10 at one time. And my father wouldn't even give her a hand to count us. But a great man to mark the board when there was darts going on in Carrigallen. A great at counting backwards, and him after spending his formative years in the Dunce's Corner at Clon School, on never missed a day, according to himself, but terribly affectionate at night when he got home from the pub, or the spirin bank, as Mammy used to call it. And then she took into having all these children, a mixture of boys and girls and Miss Prims and Lazy Drawers, and then me and Francis at the end, you know, the twins, the youngest, the Levens of the pot. And of course, poor Francis, that everyone thought was a hopeless case from the beginning, he turned out to be a teacher, or even smarter than a teacher. He was teaching teachers at one time on real good money. I built himself a fine big house near Carrigallen, and he was as far up as a professor, heading on for whatever comes after that. And that's when he got his awakening, as he called it. He got hit by the bolt of lightning, pulled in for coffee on the road to Damascus, and the head went on him. Oh, through the whole lot there, I went off to live in Mullingar. A bigger ee getting on me, he turned out on the latter end. The whole jizz gone out of him. The nerves were gone from having all the brains.
And that's Seamus O'Rourke performing a little section from The Ballad of Mossy Flood. And it's amazing, even within those couple of paragraphs there. Yeah, there's great crack and great fun in that, as Mossy describes it. But there are a couple of telltale signs in there too, Seamus, that perhaps all is not as bright and as funny as it seems. The mother bringing them to the river. Yeah, you don't go too deep down that at that point in time, and even later on the story of the brother. It is a mix. The play is a real mix of that, you know, the colour of an area like that, but the terrible sadness and deprivation and difficulties that people with problems may have growing up in an area or in a place in a situation like this.
Yeah, and we all experienced it, you know, those of us who grew up in the 70s and 80s, and there wasn't, the quality of the land, which I don't go into, but in that part of the world is very poor. So farming is, you know, everyone's just trying to eke out a living. And if you have a husband that's in the town all day, every day, it doesn't help, you know. And that was the situation in lots of places, you know. Everyone had their own troubles. So it was. And everyone found their own way out of them, you know, and that was, you know, I thought when I was a youngster, we were the only family that had no money and were poor. But I realized when you grow up that everyone was in the same situation. So but it is very much a look at that way of living. But I think that what I want running through the play is this sense that we work our way out of these things, and the thing is to keep going. And that's the case with Mossy. He wouldn't know how to stop. Which is wonderful.
Yeah, and there are another couple of great loves in his life, not least of whom is Toto the dog. Toto the dog is very important to him.
Oh, very much so. And it's strange. I wrote this play, you know, quite a while away, and it's only a few weeks ago our own dog at home passed away, and it just brought home to me how how, as a nation, we have come to be totally so much more into our animals than we were 40 years ago. I mean, 40 years ago, if a dog died, no one would pass any remarks. But nowadays, we're all very attached, and it's like a death in the family, and it's not something to be taken lightly or made fun of. I know that very much for a fact now, you know, so...
And that relationship, that relationship between Mossy, the character, and Toto, the dog, you really do get a sense that this is it's a real support for him. And as you say, family pets are often become like, you know, they are a part of the family. And it is there is a great sadness when something happens with animals like that.
There is, and it's just you know, it's that having someone or something there for you, and someone that doesn't judge, because with characters like with Mossy, everybody is making a judgment, you know, and animals don't do that. So, and that's the wonderful thing about having this animal within the place. Toto doesn't distinguish between highly intelligent people or people who have just a big heart, you know. So that rings through, it's very strange to you know, I get a lot of oohs and ahs during the play, you know, just partly because of the dog and partly because we kind of always know that maybe Mossy's romances aren't really, they're never really going to work out, but it's quite touching, you know, to for an audience to respond like that.
Yeah, and you know, there's that aspect of it, and there's a character called Monica Blake or Monica Brady that was, and she's... it's hard to describe the relationship that exists. A big relationship exists in the head of Mossy, I think, in the case of Monica. She's now Monica Blake because she's married. She's no longer Monica Brady. But you know, there's a little scene in it where he talks about, you know, where he talks about maybe not half, but suggesting to her at one stage that they might go out for a drink together. It reminded me of that scene in The Banshees of Inisherin, you know, between Barry Keoghan and Kerry Condon on the lakeside. Yeah. It had that kind of sadness in it, and yet this very kind woman who didn't want to just knock him down.
Of course, yes, and you know, although she gets married, she continues to look after Mossy and look out for him, and I think that's representative of rural communities. They will, you know, they may have their differences, or you know, they may have to call a halt somewhere along the line in something like a romance, but that doesn't mean that they stop caring for these people.
And the mother has, or he quotes the mother, Mossy quotes the mother with a great line. The mother says, "Sure, what good is love if you can't hang your coat on it?" A bit like Mossy, I'm not quite sure that I understand what that means, but I have a rough idea of the general gist of it. But how much of a magpie are you in that respect, Seamus? Are you listening to people? Are you listening to those talking around you in your local community and picking up those phrases and colourful terms?
Well, funny, that's funny you should say that, because I won't say that I have never, you know, I've often shoehorned a good spake, as we say down our way, into a play, you know, and there's lots of them. But I do in general like to let the characters say these things. And I have to say that Mossy, because he's a kind of different, he has come up with most of these things himself. You know, there a lot of the things I say in the play, I've never actually heard them, but it's a kind of when I go into Mossy mode, I can hear him saying them, and some of them don't make sense at all. Like, you know, he says, you know, when something became complicated, he says, you know, when you think about it, things get only get complicated when you start kicking all the oranges up the hill at the same time, which I don't know where that came out of, like, but and people, you know, I've found it strange with this play. I've had to allow these ones to sit a little bit, because it takes a second for an audience to go, "What did he say?"
Well, so, I mean, you know, again, I don't quite understand what kicking all the oranges up the hill at the same time means, except I do understand what it means at the same time. It just has that sense of it. The development of Mossy, how did he start? Has he been niggling at you for a long time, Seamus?
Well, it's kind of a strange thing. I had this thing in my head that I would tell a story A bit like the Father Ted and the Most Boring Priest. He's a kind of based, partly, and I hope she's not listening, but kind of based on my mother, because my mother's the worst storyteller ever. She gives you all the detail and the colour of the car and the lovely sandwiches and the, and she never gets to the point, you know, and we'd say, "Mammy, would you cut to the chase?" So I always thought that would be a lovely character to portray. And then somebody sent me a message about 6 or 7 years ago and said, "Did you hear that Longford has just been voted the most miserable place in Ireland to live?" And being a Leitrim man, I was delighted that it wasn't us for a change, you know, because we usually get targeted with those things. So I had a bit of a laugh at that. And the next morning, it was the most miserable morning. I woke up and I thought, God, I should do something, you know, to wind the Longford guys up. And I went out into the field with a tripod and put the phone on it. And I came up with this name, Mossy Flood. And I said, "My name is Mossy Flood and I'm from Longford." And it started, and I did a minute and a half of a video saying, you know, that Longford is not the most undesirable place to live. And here's why. And I told a story about a wasp coming into the chapel. Most boring story you could ever hear. And yet millions of people have watched the video because I suppose maybe the fact that I put a genuine Longford Tourism Board caption in the corner didn't
do it any harm. And that is the opening line of the play. "Hello, my name is Mossy Flood and I'm from Longford." I just want to finally mention one character, and I won't go any depth into him. Derek Chambers. I suppose it's enough to tell us what Mossy tells us about him. The hedge cutting supremo from up the ways, a contractor by nature, then he moved into property. He's the villain of the piece, I'm guessing, more or less. Listen, Seamus, it's getting near what you would refer to as the half-hour call at 25 minutes past seven to tell you it's okay, a half an hour from standby. So I better let you go and get back to that vocal warm-up and whatever else you have to do to get inside the head of Mossy from Longford. Thanks for taking the time out so close to a show to speak to us this evening, Seamus.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
That's Seamus O'Rourke, and Seamus's play, The Ballad of Mossy Flood, is at the Viking Theatre in Clontarf. It's there until the 20th of May. It goes on a nationwide tour starting from the 1st of June, starting at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, but it goes all around the place. And you can find out full details of dates, times, venues and all the rest of it on SeamusO'Rourke.com. Last Friday, we had Jaime Martín in studio to talk to us about the National Symphony Orchestra's concerts in Dublin and Galway. The National Symphony Orchestra is back in Dublin this Friday, this time under the baton of a Bavarian conductor, Christian Reif, who will be conducting Benjamin Britten's song cycle, Les Illuminations, which will be sung by American soprano Julia Bullock, who also happens to be Christian's wife. The programme also includes works by Prokofiev and Bakovich. I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Christian, newly appointed chief conductor of the, now you can pronounce, I've always said gavel, but I think there's probably a Swedish way of saying gavel symphony orchestra that doesn't sound at all like gavel, Christian. What is it?
It's Gävle.
Gävle. Thank you very much. The Gävle Symphony Orchestra.
There we go.
Not just spell it with a Y. Anyway, it's their language. They're allowed to spell it their own way, aren't they? I suppose that there are a couple of points in there, not least of which is the American soprano Julia Bullock, and you know who can't be here this evening for a very good reason.
That's right. She sent me because our son, who is 6.5 months old, this is kind of close to his bedtime. So right. I guess she's tucking him to sleep.
So she's tucking him up to sleep now and hopefully has a radio on somewhere in the background.
That's right.
And we will try not to wake him up. So should we whisper for the rest of the interview?
And he loves music. He loves her voices. So it's all good.
Yeah. Was music part of how you and Julia became husband and wife? How did that happen?
Yes, we met at Juilliard, studying at the Juilliard School in New York, and then we also made music together. Yes, but that was then after we dated and came together. So, but yes, music has been always a big part of our relationship as well. We respect each other artistically as well, and our feedbacks and so forth. So, and we love making music together. So.
Yeah, and that making of music together, I wonder to what extent are there times when you let, because you study at Juilliard. Juilliard, you're a serious musician and you're performing the music of Benjamin Britten and Prokofiev on Friday night. You know, we're talking about the height of the classical music repertoire. We're right in there at the top end of it. Are there times when you, both of you let your musical hair down and kind of slum it a little bit?
What do you mean? I mean,
is there any such thing, said you?
We love great music, and that does not is not just limited to a certain style. It's not just Western classical music that we love, but any all kinds of jazz and rock and, many, many different styles.
Well, of course, you know exactly where I'm leading with this one, because you have an album together called Walking in the Dark.
Yes.
And here from that album is a tune that everybody will recognise, I think, practically immediately. It's you on the piano, I'm guessing. Here.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And Julia doing the singing.
I wish I knew how we would feel to be free. I wish I could break all these chains holding me.
That's Julia Bullock, accompanied there by her husband, Christian Reif, in that performance of I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from their album, Walking in the Dark, and Julia and Christian performing in the National Concert Hall this coming Friday evening with the National Symphony Orchestra performing the music of, particularly the two of them, the music of Benjamin Britten, which I'll come to in a minute. But I would love to go to a party in your house, Christian. Because that feels very impromptu. It doesn't feel like a big rehearsed number. Very intimate, and the two of you.
Yeah, I mean, we also just love to sit on the piano and just improvise a little together. But we also play, Schubert and Brahms and Schumann voice cycles together, which has always been fun. But Julia is such an incredible artist in terms of her messaging and her everything. The text is at the forefront of everything she does, and so to improvise a little on the piano, it's a joy.
But I noticed that you're very generous in your improvisation, in that it's all about letting the voice and the text and the song be heard out the front. Les Illuminations, the music of Benjamin Britten, is an altogether in some ways different prospect in that regard. Talk to me a little bit about the text here, because the text is a vital part the story. It's in French, unusual for Benjamin Britten, I would have thought.
That's right. Rimbaud is an amazing collection of songs. I mean, of poems. Mm. Originally, I think it's a loose connection of 42 poems, and Paul Valin actually edited together and made, there were 42. There's no real order to it, but Britten then took several out of these Rimbaud poems, and they're so beautiful and sensual and quite surrealist in some ways. But the main thing is that Rimbaud he wanted to make sense of the world. He wanted to make sense of and make peace at some point too about this world that is baffling him. That is so. It's also hypocritical. And what does it mean to live in this world? And so the fascination also with cities.
Cities are big in the cities, and, crosses,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the attraction, but also the horror of cities and the building and the. A human kind of is so proud of what we have achieved and so forth, but is that to the detriment of nature? For instance, I mean, it's written 150 years ago, but it's still
the same worries of today.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I find particularly interesting about the I'm thinking of one of the songs, which is called "Being Beauteous." Mm-hmm, here, and this is dedicated to Peter Pears, by Benjamin Britten, of course, his lifelong partner in life. What Britten could maybe write about and have sung about in French, how different is that from what he could have spoken, considering that, where he was in history and in terms of, the criminality, the criminalization of homosexuality at the time, of homosexual acts? What can he say here that he just could not have said in an English text?
I think the poem itself, and it's so interesting that it is a in the original one, it's an English title, because Rimbaud was actually, he wrote it in England at the time. He was traveling lots, and he loved these some sentences or some words like "being beauteous" that he wanted to use. But so the title is in English, everything else in French, and that poem is so, poetic, yes, but yeah. It's so it's not as specific as maybe some of the English language would be if you talk about someone beautiful. And also the poem itself doesn't specify, is it a human being actually beautiful, or is it nature, is it an animal, is it a spirit, what is it? And so by the dedication to Peter Pears. Also, yeah. Just with the initials, actually, so it wasn't
so he didn't even say Peter Pears, he said PP.
It was very it's a beautiful love letter, so to speak, to him. But it's a little bit more vague in terms of that.
Yeah, and I guess that there's a great sadness in that, but there's a great power in that the poetry and the music can carry that emotion, even though it had to be hidden.
And the fragility also of this poem, and the crass, also the violence of part of it is immediate, and it's very beautiful. Also disturbing. So a lot of these poems are quite unsettling and incredible to listen to.
Let's listen to a little bit of Being Beauteous, because it's a wonderful, it's very typical in my mind to the kind of ethereal quality that Benjamin Britten can get into his music at times. Mm-hmm. It's certainly here in this. Let's have a listen. And this is a recording that features the soprano Suzanne Danko singing the role. That's just the opening section there of the seventh of the nine songs in total. Mm-hmm, it is Christian Reif I'm speaking to there, who's the conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra for Friday evening's concert, which will feature Les Illuminations, from which we've heard the seventh of the nine songs, sung by Suzanne Danko in a recording featuring the Orchestre de la Suisse Romande, conducted by Ernest Ansermet. I was saying as we were listening to that, I asked you about the nature of it's the strings that we hear there. And I hadn't really noticed when I was listening earlier on, but in fact, it's strings only for this.
The full song cycle, it's only strings.
And what do you think that brings to the songs, or what does it do in terms of, obviously it allows the singer, a singer isn't competing against the brass and the woodwind in simple terms.
Right. I think it opens up actually quite a lot of variety just having the strings, because they can play in many different styles. Of course, they can play like a guitar. I mean, he actually, Britten writes in the score, play like a guitar or play like a trumpet. So the opening movement, the violas and the first violins should sound like trumpet fanfares, and it's wild and it's so wonderful. And so he with the limited forces that he has with only string orchestra, he paints a huge canvas of orchestral colors.
That fanfare really struck me, that the way it's played on the strings, it sounds peculiar, but it's very effective. But I think there's a similar effect in another movement that really struck me, which is the fourth song in the cycle, which is called Royaute. Yeah. You might explain what he's at here, because I suppose it's Rambo, the original poet, is having a go at falsity and hypocrisy.
Exactly.
It's what's been targeted here.
Commentary. Many of his poems there are a commentary on social life or on social status as well. And it's actually, being very satirical in the face of people in power and poking fun at them, but also kind of so the story of that poem, basically one couple just decides for an afternoon they are going to be queen and king, and the whole village celebrates them as if they were, and so you have all these celebrations party going on throughout the whole village for that one day, and then at the end, well, they're not anymore.
Yeah, there's just such a wonderful sense of satire in both the orchestration here and the singing itself. We'll listen to a little bit of Royaute then, the fourth of the song cycle, Les Illuminations by Benjamin Britten.
Was
So that's the opening section there of Royaux, the fourth of the nine songs that make up Les Illuminations of Benjamin Britten. The Illuminations, I wondered about that title. And Christian Reif, who's the conductor for Friday night's concert with the National Symphony Orchestra, is with me in the studio this evening. I wondered about that title, Illuminations. What do you think Rambo or indeed Benjamin Britten are referring to there?
I think it's the title refers to making sense of the word, to illuminate the world, and trying to figure out what it means to live in this world, and that the artist, possibly, Rambo, is the only one who has a key to unlock this world, to unlock the savage parade, as he says. And so to, yeah, I think that could be it. It could also be illuminations. I think Rambo actually was thinking of the English title, of the English word illuminations, and also of colorful glasses and of things like that, see-through colorful glasses.
Yeah, so that all of those aspects are in there in the mix as well. And you were saying that, so the first half of the concert is Les Illuminations and also the Bechevich piece, and it's purely for strings
It's a concerto for strings, yes. And it's also what they have in common is the concerto grosso feel, which means that some of the orchestra players, usually the concertmaster, you know, principal, second, viola, bass and cello, that some of them have solo parts and playing in communication and an answer, question answer feel with the rest of the orchestra. So that both the Britten and the Bechevich work with that.
And
so
the
neoclassical, neo-baroque style.
Yeah, we refer to that as the leader of the orchestra, the concertmaster,
right.
Of course. Yeah. But is it a much reduced orchestra? The woodwind and the brass and the percussion are not there for the first. And is it a smaller string section? Is it that baroque feel?
It's basically the same. It's a slight, it's one stand.
Yeah,
less each section, but that it's still it's a
still
big string
a pretty
sound,
big string section,
and so this is a beautiful, I think, first half. And also, what is interesting, those three pieces by Bechevich, by Britten, by Prokofiev, were all written in the course of 9 or 10 years or something like that.
Yeah,
between 1939 to 48.
Yeah. But so when we get into the Prokofiev, we do have everybody's back. Everybody's on stage.
Everyone is there. It's a huge orchestra on stage.
For symphony number 5. Didn't do small, generally, Prokofiev, did he not?
Well, unless we count the first symphony. That's a little more classical, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a touch of that in there. I want to listen to a bit of the second movement. This is kind of 1944, so how political a piece is this, do you think? I mean, can a Russian composer write a piece without being political at that period in time, I guess?
Yes and no. I think, I mean, he's not Shostakovich in that sense. But Prokofiev, in many ways, was a little bit naive or a little bit removed from all the politics. It is, let's say, a heroic war symphony written in 44. I mean, you can't escape the war at that point, obviously.
And when you say heroic, I mean, how anti-war, how pro-war is maybe too strong a word, but how is he treating that theme?
So he wanted to illuminate or portray the grandeur of the human spirit, of the human mind as well. And so it is a very humane, so to speak, symphony. That's what he wanted. So it's not a calling for action, calling for violence kind of piece. It is actually, in many ways, a very joyful, very over-the-top, happy piece with a lot of dark undertones.
Yeah. Let's have a little listen to the opening of the second movement.
Very sarcastic also, yes.
Again, the sarcasm is very much to the fore here. So that's the opening section of the second movement of the Symphony No. 5 in B-flat major, the Opus 100 of Sergei Prokofiev, the symphony that will be part of Friday night's concert with the National Symphony Orchestra, Christian Reif, conductor, with me this evening. There is a lot of, we were both arching our eyebrows as we listened to that piece. It is quite arch, Christian. It is.
You
know, and yet you do get the expression of violence when that kind of bang comes in after.
When the snare drum comes in, when the trumpets come in. Yeah, exactly. There is definitely violence in there, and it's very sarcastic and with a immensely darkness to to it as well. I mean, this is not funny music. Funny or humorous comes later a little bit, also in the fourth movement, which is almost deceptively and forcefully joyful at times. But this one, I mean, it's so great the way he uses the orchestra and the different instrumentations. It's a massive orchestra, but at the same time, not everyone is playing. You know, not everyone plays all the time.
It's almost as if it walks around from one instrument to another across the orchestra. Exactly. You don't have these very big surges of romantic strings. It's a different sound.
It's a very different sound. I mean, and then you have in the symphony that bombastic tutti of everyone playing at the same time. Yeah.
One final question to go back to now that I know how to say Yevle. The Yevle Symphony Orchestra. Jaime Martin was hugely involved with the Yevle Symphony Orchestra, and here he is now as chief conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra. Is that an ongoing relationship between yourself and Jaime, or how does that relationship work?
I mean, we were just in contact actually yesterday, so he wished me a lot of fun here in Dublin. So and he's a wonderful human being and wonderful artist, and so he was with the Yevle Symphony Orchestra as their chief conductor, music director for 10 years, and so now I'm his successor, and he's just done amazing work with them, and such a collegial atmosphere that I also feel here in Dublin. And I think that's wonderful. Everyone is wanting to make music together.
I didn't make last Friday's concert, but I did hear it on playback subsequently on the Saturday evening. It was an absolutely wonderful concert. Rachmaninoff too. Big romantic Russian stuff in there, different from the sarcastic Prokofiev that you're going to give us. Best of luck now. You've avoided the witching hour that is bedtime. So now,
that's true.
Now you can go home and pretend you were working very hard.
Very hard. Yes.
Yeah, and Julia.
Well, thanks for having me.
Not at all. And best of luck to both yourself, Christian, and Julia Bullock. Christian Reif, conducting the National Symphony Orchestra this coming Friday evening with Julia Bullock as the soloist in Les Annulations by Benjamin Britten, and the other two pieces, the Prokofiev Symphony No. 5 and the Bacevich Concerto for Strings, will be the completion of that concert. You can find out full details about it all on nch.ie. The 406 days that Irish Debenhams workers spent on the picket lines was the longest dispute in Irish labour history. It all began in April of 2020 when Debenhams UK Retail Limited closed its 11 Irish stores and informed workers by email that their jobs were gone. The staff, mostly women, had been denied a previously agreed redundancy package of 4 weeks' pay, 2+2 as they called it. So pickets were mounted to prevent the company from removing stock from the stores. The story of the dispute is told in Joe Lee's new documentary film, 406 Days, which acts as a kind of oral history of the strike and highlights the determination of the staff to assert their rights. The film won the Audience Award at this year's Dublin International Film Festival, the 2023 ICCL Human Rights Film Award, and the Best Irish Documentary Award from the Dublin Film Critics Circle. As it happens, yesterday, one of the women involved in the dispute, Jane Crow, won a case at the Workplace Relations Commission over the way she was made redundant in 2020, a victory which could have implications for around 750 of her colleagues. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by the director of 406 Days, Joe Lee. The film goes on release in Irish cinemas next week. Joe, how aware of you, or were you rather, of the Debenhams dispute and the picket line when it was actually happening?
Not really at all, Sean. I live in Marino. It's only about 2 or 3 kilometres away from the flagship store on Henry Street. And I heard things on the news, but because of COVID, I hadn't been in town. So I didn't know that much about it, you know.
Because that's a vital part of this story, is the fact that these women, predominantly women, were on the picket line through that period in and around when there was total lockdown.
Well, you know, I think you can sort of see from the film that it was made in a very sort of collaborative way. But really a big part of my input into the whole process was me trying to find out what actually happened and trying to put that narrative, that chronology together.
So you went straight to the horses' mouths, as it were, straight to the women who were involved. And there were
very
some
much
men involved.
So, I mean, I'd made a documentary called Bananas on the Breadboard when I was filmmaker in residence for Dublin City Council in 2011. And that was about women street traders, kind of the people on the outside on Henry Street. My aunt had worked all her life in retail in Arnott's, and my next door neighbour had worked in Woolworths when Woolworths was around. So I kind of had, I was always interested. When I was in the art college, I worked as a part-time job in Penny's for a number of years. So I sort of had, you know, an interest and an attachment to retail. And this was an amazing opportunity to kind of explore that world of retail from the inside. But, you know, That was part of the background to it. Yeah,
because the other thing, you know, we say Debenhams and we might feel slightly at a remove from Debenhams, but if we say it was Roach's Stores Debenhams, that creates, you know, not just for people in Dublin, but, you know, the famous 8th of December visit that often those from outside of Dublin made.
Absolutely.
Roach's Stores would have been one of the real, a big calling spot.
Well, one of the things that really kind of motivated me to make it was just to try and capture that idea of the dignity of work.
Mm.
And, you know, those scenes in the film where you see the empty sort of cathedral to retail, you know, with the voices of people talking about what work actually meant, you know, to them. It was a job, it was something they were being paid for. But it was also something that may be a bit more than that, insofar as it sort of, there was a lot of meaning involved in there in people's lives. But so
the insult of
getting a generic email telling you that maybe 24 years of that was worthless.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip, which gives a real sense of the length of time that these women had spent working, predominantly women had spent working in the store, and just how close they all were. And I should be clear that it wasn't just the Debenhams store in Dublin that we're talking about here.
It's 11 stores
around
the country.
And they almost became a big family, as the film progressed.
It became a national story for me to try and tell.
So let's have a listen to just the voices of several of the women talking about how attached they were to their work and their colleagues.
I started working for Debenhams in 1996 when they first arrived in Ireland.
Somebody said to me Debenhams was coming in. So I just applied and I got the job. They did all the interviews in Croke Park, so I was put into the sports department.
When I started in Roaches in April, I think, of 1993. So between Roaches and Debenhams, I had 27 years service.
I was 30 years there when we actually closed. I went in as a summer job after my leaving cert and I never left.
I was working in the restaurant the whole time, started off over in the Jervis, and I was working there for 22 and a half years altogether.
A wonderful family atmosphere in Debenhams, the Square Tala. Everybody looked out for everybody. A lot of people stayed in that job 20 odd years. We had our babies together, we had our christenings, we had our weddings.
I started off for 11 years in the wedding gift service. That's what I did for 11 years.
I had my husband and I had my family, but I also had my job, and that was Michelle. You know what I mean? That was my whole life.
And that's Michelle Gavin, I think, is the final voice that we hear there. She's from Waterford. She was the shop steward in Waterford, wasn't she?
That's right. And most of the people that we worked with in making the film were the shop stewards group, you know.
Yeah, and we're talking to Joe Lee this evening about his documentary, 406 Days, about the closing down of the Debenhams stores. But what really comes across there, Joe, is this sense of family. You know, I don't know which of the contributors there says, we had our families, we had our children together, we had our weddings, you know, they had funerals. They lived 20 years. That's a long time to be working in the same shop.
On the first day we filmed, we brought a group back into the store. And that had been the first time that they'd been in the store since they'd got that famous generic email in April the 9th, 2020. So it had been a few years since they'd been in. And they came in and just, you know, their reaction to that place. And we picked up a lot of that material when people were reacting to being back in in the empty space that that 20 years of their lives.
Yeah, that's what I, because I must say there were sections I thought, how did Joe get access to the empty shop? Because everything was gone out of the shop at this
everything
stage.
Everything was gone.
And there's a few signs still up on the walls.
And that was amazingly tragic from those women's point of view, you know, because they had really struggled hard to try and keep the stock in the stores so that they would get paid their redundancy. So they were back, you know, in this sort of in this place, which was like a haunt, it was almost a haunted space.
How emotional a day was that? Because I saw again, I saw several of those who were in there going around with their phones, just and you could see they were filming on their phones, but looking around not through their phones to see what they were taping.
But these are an amazing group of people. These women and men, like there was men as well, but it was mostly women, and they as people they were just. Amazing at the way they could stay together and how determined they were that they wanted to try and right this wrong that they felt had been done to them. And, you know, all through making the film, like Fergus Dowd had written a book about this and he had approached me to see if I'd become involved in it. But really the making of the film was a kind of three-way split, really, because we stayed in constant conversation with the women. And Fergus was very much on board the whole way through as a producer, and then I was directing, you know.
Now things we're hearing the story, and they decide a lot of them decide, look, we can't just let this happen. We have to do something about the way we were told. We have to do something about this dispute around our redundancy pay. So they're picketing the shops to make sure that the stock is left there, so that they have some kind of collateral, so they have some kind of thing to play with as a bargaining chip, I guess. But things start to change, as we'll hear in this clip.
On March the 22nd, we closed the doors for good. The next day, which was the Tuesday, I came in, I volunteered to come in, and we had to bag up all the cash. Everything out of the tills had been cleared, all the tills had been emptied. They were left open, so if anyone looked in, they could see that there was no money in there. But we had to bag up all that money and get it ready for the bank, and we had to close down all the systems. What I did find strange, because it's something we never did, we always kept our fivers and tenors. We never sent them back to the bank, and I was told to send everything.
We came in and we were told that the reason we were coming in was to pack up the high-end stock. So that was the likes of cosmetics, Levi jeans, any of the designer wares, the electricals. They were all being packed up into cages and being locked away out of sight, that they weren't on the shop floors. And then all on the ground floor, all the exits, they packed up all cages behind them. And we're like, what's this all about? And then we were told, oh, it's in case of looting while the stores are closed. We don't want people breaking in. We don't know what's going to happen. Little did we know that we were packing away all the stock, just ready for trucks to come and take it away.
So that second voice that you heard there was Jane Crow from the Henry Street branch of Debenhams. And before that, Michelle Gavin again from Waterford speaking about what they had to do down there. So they knew that they had to, they blockaded the trucks coming in and out for a long, long time,
essentially,
Joe.
Yeah, because they felt it was, you know, it was a tactical, this was a tactical insolvency.
So did you speak, by the way, in that respect? Did you speak to anybody from Debenhams or the liquidators?
Very much from the very beginning, the decision was to make a film. From the point of view of what was it like to be on a strike for 406 days from the women, mostly women's point of view, but there were plenty of men as well who took their part.
Let's remember, these were 24 hours a day, 7 days a week pickets in rain come, rain, hail or shine.
I think you might have sort of, you saw what the landscape was like. The landscape with loading bays, and loading bays are often sort of dirty, cold, wet sort of places. So that was very much the landscape for the, you know, that the film was sort of visually made in.
There is another important visual aspect I just thought was interesting in general terms. There's quite a lot of citizen journalism, if you like. Quite a lot of social media. You must have waded through a lot of stuff, Joe.
You know, I have to take my hat off to Fergus on this, because Fergus sort of got the stuff in, collated it, presented packages of it to me. I went through it. We discussed it. We went back. He found better versions of things.
And it was really involved, you could corroborate the various things that you showed.
And it's one of the things I'm really sort of delighted that I've met Fergus. We're working together as director producer on a new project about the Dublin Monaghan bombing.
And which today, of course, today was a significant anniversary.
So hopefully we'll have that for this time next year.
That will be the 50th anniversary.
But the amazing thing about this film in a way was that it was made really quickly, you know.
Yeah.
We'd only begun to film about a year ago, and we're in cinemas on the 26th.
In cinemas too, that must be a great joy.
Well, it's amazing for me because, you know, you want what you do to be seen by the public. And often that's not the case. And Eclipse Pictures are working really hard with us to get the film out and to get people to see it.
17 cinemas nationwide is where it will be found from Friday the 26th of May. That's Joe Lee, director of the documentary 460, I beg your pardon, speaking to me this evening. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields researched, Gar Duffy was on sound, Mary Elizabeth Bruton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I'll talk to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1, and Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.